Elections Committee. The first bill on the agenda is Representative Bigham, but we do not have a quorum. However, I did receive an interesting exchange. Representative Bolshager, did you enter on the state office building side of the transportation building this morning? And did was there an individual that opened the door for you this morning? And that individual, I think, had a request of you, Representative Bolshager. And what was your reply to that individual?
Chair Pawlowski, he asked for a tip. He opened the door for me and he asked for a tip, and I said, good job.
Representative Bolshager, I only bring it up because there were two members of the House that, that witnessed this exchange, and there was no recognition on your part of those two members, and they were then, subsequently, they contacted me. So I just wanted you to know that they were aware of this. You wouldn't happen to know who those two members were.
Chair Pawlowski, am I staring at one right now? Or?
Representative Wolfiger, there are members that do walk every day back and forth. They may be somewhat disguised as homeless people, but they're still worthy of recognition. With that, Representative Bigham, until we have a quorum, I will move that House Bill 3138 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Finance Committee, but we will not act on that until we have a quorum. Representative Bigham, to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to point out that I am wearing my Winona State button because I'm a proud alum, Mr. Chair. House File 3138.
Representative, a little decorum.
House File 3130.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3130 is the bill that ratifies the labor contracts for the contracts and the compensation plans for employees in the executive branch. The seven contracts, two compensation plans have been reviewed and during the interim were approved by the Subcommittee of Employee Relations, of which I'm the Vice Chair. And there's nothing controversial in it. I will let Mr. Hubinger talk about the details. The one thing that is a little different about it, we did put in a provision that would eliminate the salary limit for the administrator of the Minnesota Zoo. Currently it's limited to 130% of the governor's salary, and anything above 95% has to come from non-state funds or private funds. So we're just removing that cap, and it's only for the director of the zoo. So I can have Mr. Hubinger go through the details, like the 3.5% increase in the healthcare stuff.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. The bulk of the bill ratifies labor contracts for state employees. These contracts were negotiated by the administration with the state employee unions. The contract would ratify seven contracts and two compensation plans. The pattern that developed as a result of the bargaining was that most employees will receive a 3.25% across the board increase in each of the two fiscal years. In addition, most employees will receive merit increases or performance-based increases that range between 2.5% and 3.5% if they're not at the top of their salary ranges. Across the labor contracts, about half of the employees are at the top of their ranges and so won't receive these increases. The other provisions, major provisions, relate to CGIP, the State Employee Group Insurance Program. This program provides insurance coverage for about 150,000 lives. There were no major changes in there. The premiums increased about 6.7% the first year, and they're projected to increase about 10% in the second. As you know, this plan also applies to members and staff of the legislature and members of the judicial branch. The cost of these contracts, the result of the bargaining, the cost will increase about 5.8% in the this biennium. And when you count in the tails, the cost will increase about 8.7% in the next biennium. Mr. Chair, that's an overall view of the contract settlement.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? No? Questions? Representative Emmer. I'm sorry, sir. Your name was Greg.
Mr. Chair, Greg Hubinger.
Representative Emmer, his name is on the, if you look at the front sheet.
I wasn't looking at that, Mr. Chair.
He's the director, so.
All right. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Sir, I have a couple of questions. How do these, I'm looking at some of these raises in the contracts. There's one in here for 6.5%, and it just caught my eye because I don't know that folks in the private sector are going to see any increase close to that this year. How do the contracts that are listed under Section 2 and the increases that are listed in there, how do those compare to similarly situated persons employed in the private sector? Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, these contracts were negotiated by the Department of Employee Relations representing the government's office in the executive branch with the state employee unions. I know that they have innumerable discussions with Dewar about what comparable increases are with the private sector. The state labor negotiator is here if you'd like to ask him about what the administration's perspective was on that.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to have...
Representative Bingham, why don't we have the negotiator come up and answer that question. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the state labor negotiator for the Department of Employee Relations.
And to Representative Emmer's question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the state bargaining units for which the Department of Employee Relations has oversight, which are in all of the bargaining units except for the MNSU faculty agreement, so we have the law enforcement, the professional unit, the absentee units, the nurses, the engineers, and so on. And we have a variety of challenges in this, in the sense that we do look at external comparisons with regard to market as far as compensation. There's also a provision in 43A which requires us to look at internal equity as well. The salary increases for this round of bargaining averaged about 3.25% on the across-the-board increases. We also have performance increases in the form of what we call step increases for employees who are eligible if they're not at the top of the pay scale. When you look at the other public sector jurisdictions, step increases are also a feature that are commonly found in other public sector settlements. I think that with regard to what's going on as far as other settlements out there in other jurisdictions, our settlement that we have with our labor contract is in the market. In some instances, I think there are other occupations that their settlements are even higher than ours, but I believe that our settlements this round have at least maintained our competitive edge out there with the other jurisdictions.
Representative Emmer. Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Larson. Actually, my question was, how do these raises, and you've actually explained something that I didn't understand from Mr. Hubinger, in that not only have an increase, for instance, of 3.5% or up to 6.5% in some cases, but we also have these step increases, the bonus, if you will, that somebody would be eligible for, depending on where they are. Those are two separate things. I didn't understand that when Mr. Hubinger was giving his testimony. But my question is very direct. It's I understand you did a good job of negotiating this on behalf of the state, but how do these exactly compare to private sector jobs in the same field?
Mr. Larson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I would say that in some instances that they're probably below. I think that what we try to do is we look at total compensation when we look at this, our external market. And then the other thing is that a lot of our jobs, there really is no external market. I mean, where is the external market for correctional officers, for example? We do have, I think, external markets when we look at clerical. We don't have an external market for private sector market when we look at law enforcement. We have an external market when we look at engineers. We have an external market when we look at nurses. But then, again, those are also public sector. I also believe that when you look at, maybe our overall wage settlement might be lower. What I also know that in the private sector, it's not uncommon for employees to pay $400 or $500 a month for family coverage, where in our state system you pay about $125 for family coverage. So those are all the things that I factor into this. So I hope that answers your question, but it's a very complex argument which I'm faced with all the time, and I'm usually able to defend our state settlement. Quite frankly, I think our settlements are responsible. I think that they are they're not overly generous, and I'm comfortable with the settlements that what we have here.
So we don't belabor this. Mr. Larson, I'm wondering if you could provide me with, before this thing finds its way to the floor, I'd like a summary of the specific jobs we're talking about so that I can go out and do a comparison. And please know, my questions are not intended at all to imply some criticism of what you've done or what the employees that are subject to these contracts are entitled to or not. That isn't my point. But I think that you give the example of correction officers. There is a market out there for private employed correction officers. And I think that as a representative of folks in my district that are suffering tremendously in the trades, for instance, that I should be able to answer them and tell them, well, you know, this is where the public sector employees are, and this is where you are, and this is how it's compared. So if you don't mind, I'd like to get that information so I can look at it. And then this is for... The next question, I think, I don't know if Mr. Larson can answer it, but I'll ask it as long as he's here in case. Mr. Hubinger, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hubinger had testified that generally to the percentage increase and what this will do, I'd like a number. Could you tell me what the number is, the actual dollars that the state of Minnesota is committing to if these contracts get ratified? And when I say a number, the difference between what the rates are right now that we are already paying versus what these 3.25 to 6.5% increases plus the step increases that half of these employees may be entitled to. What is that number?
Mr. Larson or Representative Bigham?
Mr. Chair, my good friend, Representative Emmer, the amount is $261,900,000. Thought that was another zero there.
Representative Emmer, does that answer the question?
I have one more.
Representative Emmer.
Mr.
That's
Chairman.
The new biennial money. I'm
Representative
that, I understand that's the new money, and how many employees?
Mr. Larson, perhaps you might want to respond to that.
I don't know that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, that's about 35,000 employees.
Thank you, Mr. Larson.
Mr. Larson, I have a question for you. The fiscal forecast will be coming out tomorrow, and subsequently it is likely to be larger than the December forecast. It is likely also that we will have negative numbers passing out of this body in all of our fiscal divisions. These contracts will be signed. I assume they're going to be approved. Should then there be base cuts across these agencies, the state would then result in doing what as a result of these contracts? Do you know where I'm going with this?
Sure. Mr. Chair,
Larson.
I can tell you just anecdotally what we've had to deal with. Once these contracts are approved, they cannot be unraveled without the term is often called impairment of contract. So once that contract is in place, we have to honor the contract. So as a result of that, I'm comfortable from the current affordability of what the legislature appropriated in the last biennium for these contracts. If there are cuts that are imposed on the state agencies, this will impact the services that the state agencies are required to perform in the sense of not filling positions or rolling back on certain services. And it will depend on the agency. The other thing that it does is that it's the funding source is also one of the things that we factor in. And while Representative Bigham gave you that number, we do have agencies where we have a lot of federal dollars, a lot of dedicated funds, a lot of revolving funds. And so typically what we try to do is we watch the general fund portion of the money, but with the 100 plus agencies that we have out there, it depends on the funding stream that funds those salaries and the operations of those agencies.
So Mr. Larson, in simple terminology, there would either be a reduction in services and or a reduction in the complement of those agencies.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct, and I think also I would add that with the degree of the pain and the degree of the impact would be on the funding stream.
All right. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, I'm looking through this summary of the settlement with the different sections and different groups. And I'm looking for the numbers that Representative Emmer mentioned, the 6.5% increase. And the only place I see it is under the medical specialist section. Could you describe to us what is unique about that 6.5% increase for the medical specialists that would make it so much larger than the others? Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, while we try to have what I would call a uniformity with the how we bring these settlements in, we also have certain market issues and we also have certain occupational pressures that are facing us. One of the areas that we are in that situation is with medical specialists, or the term most of us are more familiar with, our doctors, and in particularly psychiatrists. This is a problem that we have with the Department of Human Services, the Department of Corrections, and the Veterans Home, as well as the Health Department, and it varies. What we're experiencing in greater Minnesota is the Department of Human Services needs to provide those kinds of services out there, and also balancing the overall budget and the amount of money that we had. The feature that we have with the medical specialists was that for the 3.25% each year, which we have in our other labor agreements, what we did was we, instead of doing 3.25% each year, we put that the departments could do 6.5% starting the first year. They didn't have to, but that's then, of course, if you start with 6.5% in the first year, you're spending money faster, and so we had to report the potential of that. So in the numbers that you see before you here, the practice for the Department of Employee Relations to give what we consider the worst out scenario from a costing point of view. I'm not sure. We gave the departments that flexibility after we met with them. I do believe that in greater Minnesota that is going to be the plan for our ability to recruit medical specialists in greater Minnesota. I know that in some of the other agencies that employ medical specialists, that's a feature that they won't be using.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Larson, for this group of about 65 medical specialists, you're accelerating the two-year increase and putting it all in the front in the first year. You're front-loading it, in essence. There will be only one increase, but it will be the combined amounts that all the other groups are getting over the 2 years. Is that what you're saying,
Mr. Larson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's correct.
Thank you very much, sir.
Are there any further questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, I understand that my question was asked before I got here, but I'd like to follow up. It has to do with whether or not all you folks in the department have evaluated where the private sector marketplace wages are going and what's happening on that front as it compares to public sector. I understand the complications of that. I wonder if you could explain the complications of that comparison and whether or not you could provide all of us on the committee with the same information that you acknowledge would provide for Representative Emmer.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, this was also asked of Representative Emmer. I'd be happy to report that, but anecdotally, in my position as a state labor negotiator, I am always concerned about our ability to recruit and retain and compare with other jurisdictions. We commonly look at other public sector jurisdictions. We try not to look at the private sector, but some of our job classes do indeed mirror what the public sector settlements and benefits are. We have a defined contribution pension plan. Private sectors have 401ks. Private sectors don't have sick leaves and vacation benefits similar to ours. The insurance contribution changes. And so we have a host of challenges in our comparison out there. But I can tell you from other public sector jurisdictions, settlements that are coming in right now for other government jurisdictions are ranging anywhere from 2.5% to 5%.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up. I appreciate if you could get us that information as quickly as possible. And I just want to highlight, you describe it as a challenge. And in many ways I can see how it would be a challenge. But when you look at just your first example of a defined benefit plan versus 401ks, from my experience, the state employees, all of us have an advantage with that plan, and it's a higher level of compensation, a greater benefit. And that, to me, is not a challenge to determine that difference. And it should be considered in all the negotiations because we should be competitive with the private sector as well.
Mr. Larson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I and Representative Olson, I agree. In my position, I believe that as the employer, I think that we have a competitive salary. I think that we are within our markets in a lot of our jobs. I think we're doing a good job. I don't think that we overspend, and I think that we're holding our own. And I'm actually quite frankly proud to defend our position in labor relations and negotiations on where we stand.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? No further questions. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3138 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Members, before we get to the next bill, tomorrow there will be at least one motion on the floor to bring some bills from Representative Kahn's committee, I believe, to this committee. And they will be then used for a series of election bills. I just want the members to know that those motions will take place, and if you have any questions, you can talk to Representative Kahn or myself. Those bills will then be heard next week, and we will be using them for a series of what we would hope would be non-controversial election bills. Representative Kahn?
Does that include the elimination of the Lieutenant Governor?
Representative Kahn, at this time it does not. But
that
you
will
might
be a
want
separate
to
bill?
Representative Kahn, I think that will be a separate bill.
Oh, okay.
And we have some.
It could be a non-controversial addition to one of these others.
Representative Kahn, we have some people who testified here last week who want to be made aware of that bill so that they can testify against it. Younger people.
Right.
Part of the Representative Kahn fan club, I believe. So, members, if you have any questions on that, you can talk to Representative Kahn. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3292, Representative Dietrich. Representative Dietrich, I will move that House File 3292 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 3292 addresses the fiscal management and oversight of the school trust lands, and it expands the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee membership as well, redefines the mission of that committee. A little bit of background for those of you who are not quite as familiar on school trust lands. At statehood, the federal government gave Minnesota state land to be held in trust where the money is to be, according to the Minnesota State Constitution, invested to secure the maximum return in order to benefit the school districts of this state. The DNR was given the trust to manage these lands. It is the State Board of Investment who invests the net income produced from the land and annually distributes the proceeds to the school districts. Then there is a permanent school fund advisory committee that we, that the legislature has created, and it is made up of legislators and educators who are charged to, with overseeing the DNR's management of the school trust land. Over the interim, Representative Dreiling, Chair Dreiling of the Education K-12 Finance Committee, asked that I chair a work group on school trust lands. So I started investigating school trust lands, and at the same time, Senator Leader in the Senate was setting to look into school trust lands because he was assigned to this permanent school fund advisory committee, and he was a little miffed as to what his role was and how this committee was functioning. So we went up north, the guests of the DNR, and toured school trust lands. I can't tell you the roads at Representative Emmer, but if I did try, oh, I guess he's not listening. Oh, well, I thought it was good. So anyhow, we went up north and we took a two-day tour of the different lands, and it was very enlightening. The DNR was extremely helpful, and there have been four bills that have evolved out of that trip. House File 3292 is one of them. And then in since the trip and more recent research on the topic, I did some time looking at the 1998 Legislative Auditor's Report in regards to school trust lands. And they made many recommendations, and there was other correspondence surrounding that auditor's report that made recommendations about the school trust lands. And I was really quite surprised at how some of their recommendations really coincided with some of the things that I thought could be done to improve the performance of those lands. And I'd like to point out just a couple of them because you have them in your packet. One is the executive summary of the Legislative Auditor's Report. I'd like to point out under the recommendations, the bullets number 3 and 4. Number 3, it says the legislature should require the DNR to report regularly on the school trust land management. The fourth bullet, the legislature should consider constitutional and statutory changes to maximize the fund's future growth. The second document is in the summer oversight and management of the trust land, and it is a summary that looks like this, and I believe you have it in your packet.
No.
Representative Dietrich, members may not have that right.
Oh, I'm
so
sorry.
So if you just pause for a second.
I thought my legislative assistant had made the copies. And
I think these were under Mr. Malander's door this morning.
Oh.
And we weren't exactly sure what they were. And now we are sure what they are. So
I am going to go ahead and continue.
You certainly may continue.
You can look at that at your own time.
Proceed.
Okay, in the summary, in the second paragraph, the last sentence, it says, but we think that the DNR should consider the possibility of assigning specific staff responsibility for coordinating the school trust lands activities within the department. The third document I'd like to point out that you will be getting shortly is a letter from James Noble, Legislative Auditor. And he writes in the second paragraph, second to the last line, the legislature, which has not always given consistent direction to the DNR on trust fund issues, could benefit from better information and analysis from the DNR. And then the fourth document that I would like you to look at is the letter from former state legislator and finance commissioner Wayne Siminoff. And in point number 3 in his letter, he says the legislature should authorize the department to employ permanent staff for the advisory committee using permanent school fund resources. As I mentioned, these concerns that were brought up in 1998 resembled my concerns. And so if, Mr. Chairman, if you're ready, what I'd like to do is walk through the bill.
Yes. Representative Dietrich.
Okay, thank you. Section 1 of the bill. gives the DNR commissioner the authority and responsibility for administering the permanent school funds. As we ask questions about school trust land funds, the DNR continually reassured us that it is the commissioner who is ultimately responsible. We thought it was important to recognize that in statute. Also in Section 1, it directs the commissioner to report annually to the school fund advisory committee on maximizing permanent school fund revenue. The third thing it does in Section 1 is it directs the commissioner to designate a permanent professional staff person with certain charges and makes this person a non-voting member of the permanent school fund advisory. So I hope you can see that we have addressed some of the things that have been brought up in the past.
Representative Dietrich, what's the position of the commissioner on this?
In regards to school trust lands?
Well, in regards to Section 1.
Does the commissioner have...
My question is, what is the position of the commissioner with these new responsibilities? Do we have someone here who can speak to the commissioner?
Oh, yes.
Let's have Bob Myers. Yes. Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record. You may want to stay there for just a little while.
That's always a scary time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you today, we do support. You can see the goals of the committee on lines 2.29 to 2.26. Improving the efficiency of our management, reducing expenditures, accelerating land exchanges, sales, and commercial leasing, and managing the trust lands to maximize the long-term economic return. We are 100% in favor of this. We're taking these activities on right now. In the past couple of years, we've exchanged all of the non-revenue-making lands out of our state parks into other lands with trust status. We're working on improving those all school trust lands for revenue enhancement, trying to figure out ways to access the 100,000 acres, not access, but deal with the 100,000 acres in the DWCA. You can't generate any revenue off of those lands. But the questions that you asked me, Mr. Chair, regarding the position and some of the issues in front of you today in this committee, on lines 1.16 to 1.18, having this permanent staff position also be responsible for serving as a non-voting member of what I consider a legislative committee kind of blurs that line between legislative and executive branch. As you look on page 2.15 to 2.20, the language says the advisory committee must also include the non-voting professional staff, and this staff will provide the committee with professional advice and technical support. The chair of the committee shall be elected by the members, etc. Again, it's just that gray area of executive legislative branch separation. And then on 3.1 to 3.2, having this non-voting member of the advisory committee work with the committee to prepare the annual report. Those are just some of the issues that we have concerns about. Also, the members that we're looking to appoint here, 2.11 to 2.13, expertise in minerals, forestry, mining, real estate development, renewable energy, and finance. We need to make sure as we appoint these people, we aren't setting up any conflicts of interest, because these are the same people who will want to be generating extra revenue off the land. So we'll just have to do that very carefully, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Mr. Meyer, I've got a couple questions for you. My first question is, should we adopt this, even with the gray areas, would it reduce or eliminate a long-standing antagonistic relationship of your department with certain members of the legislature, particularly those that live in the northern part of the state?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't think any legislation passed could do that. It will help us, Mr. Chair, definitely.
It's unfortunate. I was hoping that we would at least eliminate a few speeches during session. The gray areas you refer to, you have no amendments to bring forward at this time to clarify those gray areas?
Mr. Chair, no.
Mr. Meyer, the document that's before us, the bill that's before us, did you participate in the draft of this? Or was this drafted and now you're accepting it?
Mr. Chair, members, we did participate in several meetings and provided comments. However, we did not actually participate in the drafting, or some of our comments were accepted, some of them weren't, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You asked one of my questions dealing with certain members of this body. But my question to the author is, I'm looking at the co-authors on this bill. None of them are from northern Minnesota or from where these school trust lands are. So I'm wondering, do we have our support? Mine and Rukavina's and others.
I don't know if Mr. Meyer can answer that, but perhaps Representative Dietrich could, and I didn't mention any particular members, but since those names have come out, Representative Dietrich, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I can't say that Representative Rukavina supports this bill, and when you look at the issue of school trust lands, and maximizing the revenue, the usage of the land, there is a whole gamut of ways that around the United States that they have handled that. Some is taking all of the authority away from the DNR and creating their own commission. And so there are some people that would probably prefer to go to that extreme. The approach that I have taken is the first phase of this, and see if we can get better results with taking smaller steps first before having, creating a lot of antagonistic feelings. So, no, I don't think Representative Rukavina would support this bill.
Representative Howe,
yes, Mr. Chairman, now I know why the DNR is supporting the bill.
Representative Howe, I wasn't as blunt as you, but I was trying to get to that point now that we're there. Representative Rukavina does not support the bill. The bill is being referred to the Finance Committee, and of course that would be the first time we hear Representative Rukavina's opinion, probably at length, on the bill. Just as an FYI to members as they vote. Mr. Meyer, you have anything else to say at this time? Just stay there, though, I think, for a second. Representative Dietrich, we interrupted you. Do you want to proceed?
Yes, on to Section 2 of the bill. Section 2 of the bill adds health and sanitation, wealth, finance, and environmental chairs, and five individuals with specified areas of expertise. What we are trying to do there is we are trying to add some finance experience and private sector experience to that committee. It allows the legislators to make recommendations to that committee, and yet the commissioner, the DNR commissioner, is ultimately responsible for appointing those people to that committee. It directs the committee to annually submit a report in a draft legislation to the legislature on managing the school trust lands, and it requires the committee's annual report to make recommendations for improving the DNR efficiency, reducing management costs, expenses, and accelerating land transfers, and maximizing the economic return to the legislature.
Mr. Meyer, do you anticipate a fiscal note on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members, one has been requested. We're in the process of developing that at this time.
So, Mr. Meyer, you anticipate there will be a cost?
Mr. Chair, members, the cost may be work that won't be done from this person. If we decide to make it an existing staff person, we will have to identify what activities that person won't be doing while they're doing this. If it is determined that this is a new person, then there will be a new cost associated with that.
Mr. Meyer, you were here during the preceding bill in the discussion on what we're going to face after the fiscal forecast tomorrow. I don't anticipate that your department or any department is going to get a positive number out of this legislature. So this is not a fiscal division, but I am concerned at the number of bills that are passing through the body that have fiscal notes attached to them and the size of those, considering what we'll be dealing with from Thursday forward. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to say that I am not advocating for an additional staff person. I think that since the school trust lands is supposed to be first and foremost the maximizing the revenues from the school trust lands is supposed to be first and foremost in the interest of the school district. I think, and the DNR has said over and over again that is where their priorities lie. They understand their role as a trustee, and that the school district revenue is their highest priority when dealing with those lands. So I think that they should have enough management within the DNR that they could just focus some of that and streamline it and have one person that is responsible for all of the information.
Representative Dietrich, I appreciate that and I understand that. However, if a fiscal note is attached to this, when it goes to the Finance Committee, I think it'd go to Representative Wagenius's committee probably from there. The problem that we're going to face is going to be a serious one starting tomorrow. So it isn't, we don't attach the fiscal note. And if there is one attached, that will have to be dealt with. So I believe we have one more person who wishes to testify. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself for the record.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. I'm Grace Schwab. I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, and we are in full support of this bill. It's really a two-pronged attack to the School Boards Association. It's plugging up and getting this money, plus if it's constitutionally dedicated to our kids, back into K-12, and better management of the DNR. And as you mentioned earlier, there's some conflict going around on how do you improve that management, and a lot of frustration dealing with the DNR in the past. And this is sort of a middle of the road. Let's see what we can do with this. As far as the conflict of interest that they talked about, I'd like you to think about the Workers' Compensation Task Force. That's an executive, legislative members on that body. So there are other organizations that have that kind of grouping as they go forward without conflict of interest issues happening. And last but not least, the fiscal note. This is a fund, if you look at fiscal years 02 through 07, the gross and net revenues from these school trust funds, that in fiscal 07 is looking at having $11.4 million in costs to the trust fund. And I don't believe it's wholly inappropriate to have a person that you can call on to answer your questions and prepare this report for the legislature to keep on top of this issue. And last but not least.
Well, Ms. Schwab, you may not, but there may be members of the Northern delegation that would think taking money from this fund to hire state employees would. I'm just anticipating what might happen in finance. Mm-hmm. Proceed.
Yep. Basically, the more information we go going forward, I think as we look at some of the richness and the possibilities of our state, can really be captured in this fund and provide growth over time for school districts. There is a run for school districts on how much money they would see off this program that's included for your packet. And once again, it's the growth over time, the better management, and giving it back to K-12 that are both parts of this bill. And we'd like to thank Representative Dietrich for all her hard work and dedication in this difficult area.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, not to complicate our life, but Mr. Meyer just suggested an oral amendment, and it was to online, and I hope we have the same versions here, on line 1.13, the commissioner shall designate, if we inserted and changed the A to AN, and we then inserted the word existing, that would...
Representative Dietrich, we don't do oral amendments, but if there is an amendment and we can get Mr. Shepherd to clarify the amendment, we will then move the amendment so that it is clear in the minutes what the amendment is. So if you would repeat that for Mr. Shepherd, and then when he clarifies what it is, I'll move the amendment so we know what it is.
Thank you very much.
Do that again, please. Thank you.
Okay. On line 1.13, change the A to AN. And then insert the word existing.
Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I think that works the way that Representative Dietrich stated it on page 1, line 3. Just read, the commissioner shall designate an existing permanent professional staff person.
All right, I'll move that as an amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. Representative Dietrich, to your bill.
In summary, I would just like to say that House File 3292 strengthens the role of the legislature in maximizing the revenue generated from the school trust fund lands and calls closer attention and oversight to the usage of the school trust fund lands, which we already do have those current obligations.
Any further discussion?
Anyone else wish to testify? Then I'll renew my motion that House File 3292, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Representative Dietrich, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I believe. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3130, Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy, I'm going to move that House File 3130 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. So, Representative Murphy, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. I have a bill here that creates a Child Care Advisory Task Force to be appointed by the Department of Human Services, and I have an amendment to put the bill in order, and that is the K-1 amendment, and it should be in your packet.
Representative Murphy, what amendment was that one?
The A1 amendment.
A1 amendment. Representative Murphy, I will move the A1 amendment. All right, to your amendment.
The amendment changes the enactment date.
Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair, members, this amendment would make the bill effective the day after final enactment.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This task force appointed by the Department of Human Services will hold public meetings, will report to the legislature on January 15th of 2009, will sunset on January 30th of 2009. We request no per diem or expenses for the members, and we do not anticipate a fiscal note.
I'm sorry, Representative Murphy, can you repeat just the last part of what you
said? We do not anticipate a fiscal note.
All right. Any discussion? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have is, I know this is for the children, but Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, why do we need to do this? I mean, don't we have an apartment that already is doing this kind of stuff?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The reason why I think that we should do this is because over time, the application process and the bureaucracy around child care, the child care assistance program has grown large. And advocates would like to streamline that both for those people applying for assistance and for the Department of Human Services itself. So I believe that this task force will bring simplification both for the applicants and streamline the bureaucracy, and I think that's important.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Murphy, I think we can just maybe agree to disagree, since I know my small voice in this matter won't carry this issue at all, but I don't see the solution to the bureaucracy that you're complaining about as being more bureaucracy. So, again, I know you're doing this for the children, but I urge a no vote. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murphy, do you have anyone who wishes to testify for the bill? I have one person here, James Carlson. You want Mr. Carlson, if he's here?
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Carlson is here and ready to answer questions, but because we're here to talk about the task force, I thought I might be able to muster through that on my own.
All right. Any other questions? Anyone else wish to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, then I'll remove my motion that House File 3130 as amended be passed and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next bill on the agenda is Representative Hortman, House File 863. Come where? Representative Portman, before I make a motion on this, given the rather complicated and some would say convoluted committee structure that we have, If we break out of the policy tier and send you to the finance tier, and then you have to break out of that and come back down to the policy tier, your bill could be mired in a morass of difficulty. So where do you want this bill to go?
I would like it to go to Representative Atkins' Commerce Committee next.
Representative Horton, it's good because that's what I had in my note. I'm glad you confirmed that. So I will move that House File 863 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee. Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. The chair of the committee asked that we focus on the rulemaking aspects of the bill in this committee, since that's the purview of this committee. But given that it is a complex bill, we discussed also that I should provide some framework of the entire structure of the bill so you have some idea where the rulemaking piece fits in.
Representative Hartman, before you start, where is this bill in the Senate and what action has been taken on it in the Senate?
Mr. Chair, there was a hearing in environment policy on the day and at the time we were working on the transportation override, and my understanding is it was tabled. I don't know if it was tabled because we ran out of time or everybody wasn't there or going to be working a little harder to get a successful outcome in that committee.
Representative Hartman, was it tabled or was it laid over?
Laid over.
Representative Hartman, I bring it up because there was some confusion when we put the bill on the agenda, and it has been a preference of the chair, a list of requirements, and one of them was if the bill isn't moving in the Senate given our timeline, that the preference would be not to take up those bills at this time. So you are an exception due to an oversight, and I hope you operate under that exception with all expediency.
Mr. Chair, I'll be working on my House-Senate relationships later today.
Representative Horton, those aren't the ones I was really concerned about. I was more concerned about our relationship here in this body. But let us proceed. And again, let's focus as much as we can on the unique rulemaking characteristics of this bill, because that's why it is in this committee. I would hope we would avoid. There are numerous other issues we could debate at length here, but we're here because of the rulemaking. So, Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the bill before you, the Minnesota Clean Car Standards Act, is an air emission standard for vehicles in Minnesota. Right now, under federal law, under the Clean Air Act, a state has two choices. A state may opt into the federal standard or the California standard. California has a stricter standard for emissions from motor vehicles because they regulated emissions from motor vehicles before the United States Congress acted in the Clean Air Act. California has regulated certain pollutants from cars since the early 70s, those that produce smog. In 2002, there was an amendment passed in the California legislature that was to take effect in 2006 that would add greenhouse gas pollutants to the list of pollutants that were regulated under the California standards. And the greenhouse gas reduction standards have been the subject of some controversy in litigation and in politics. And you may be aware of the fact that the cases have all been resolved in favor of the California standards. Right now, the only outstanding issue is that the EPA has denied a waiver for the first time since the Clean Air Act was put into place in 1970 to California to implement a segment of its Motor Vehicle Emissions Act. So that issue will be resolved by January 2009, if not earlier, because every single candidate running for president has indicated they would issue the waiver to California after the election. So the issue that we have here before your committee, Mr. Chair, is the exemption from rulemaking. Because under federal law, Minnesota is restricted from either doing what the EPA regulates or doing what California regulates, we can't choose our own standards. There is no reason for us to draft our own rules. They cannot take effect under federal law. And Mark Sheppard has prepared a memo for members, and I think it might be useful, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman, what I'm going to do now is have Mr. Sheppard just go over that memo briefly for members. It's in your packet. So, Mr. Sheppard.
Mr. Chair and members, as Representative Portman indicated that I have a memo in the packet that just comments briefly on some of the rulemaking issues in this bill. You'll notice in Representative Portman's bill on page 2, line 6, and again on page 2, line 15, references adopting rules under section 14.388. So the first thing that the memo does is explain what that means. This is a good cause exemption that's in current law that can be used when a rule is incorporating specific changes set forth in statutes when no interpretation of law is required. And so that's what's referenced here. When that occurs, what happens is that the agency basically gives notice that it is going to adopt rules under this exempt rulemaking. The revisor of statutes approves the form of those rules. The Office of Administrative Hearings approves the legality. It's published in the State Register, and then it takes effect. And this can be used only when authorized by the legislature in these type of circumstances when, as it states in the statute and in Representative Hortman's bill, that it incorporates specific changes set forth in statutes when no interpretation of law is required. The other thing that I've noted in my memo is that this bill is somewhat unusual in that it adopts by reference the California regulations. So on page 2 of the memo, I've just given you some examples of other current Minnesota laws that adopt outside bodies of law or rule by regulation. The most common one is that our Minnesota tax laws adopt by reference many of the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. Also, there's in our education laws, we've adopted by reference some standards set by other bodies in school bus safety, the building code. And so it's not unprecedented to adopt by reference things that are printed somewhere else. The last thing I did in my memo was just note that this bill also directs the PCA in the future to adopt future changes to the California rules, because the federal law requires that to be in conformance with the California rules. And so I've ended my memo by just analyzing a little bit some of the legal issues that apply when the legislature is adopting future changes in some other document. And I pointed out that this one is a little bit different from the cases in the memo because these changes in the future would not take effect automatically. Rather, the legislature is just giving direction to the PCA on what rules to adopt in the future. So, Mr. Chair, that's a brief overview. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, from Mr. Shepard. So I just want to make sure I understand as I'm scanning the memo. So if California law were to change, what would happen?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon and members, Representative Portman's bill on page 2, beginning on line 12, provides that if the California rules change, then the commissioner of the PCA would be required to amend the rules in a timely fashion to minimize the time during which our rules aren't identical to California's. And then it references the federal law that requires that. And on the back of the memo that I wrote, I republished the section of the federal law that is referenced in Representative Portman's bill.
Representative Simon, does that answer your question? Mr. Shepard, I have a follow-up question to that. In the examples that you gave us, have we ever adopted this type of a structure where we may have taken rules from another state in other areas, but have we ever then stipulated that if their rules change, our rules automatically change?
Mr. Chair and members, the one example where I am aware of that is not with respect to other state rules, but with federal regulations. In some of the health and human service areas, there have been cases where, in order to attain conformity as required to receive funding under federal law, I think some of the health and human services laws adopt future, that they say that we adopt whatever the federal code and regulations are at any given point in time in the future. I'm not aware offhand of adopting another state regulations.
But Mr. Shepard, under the Constitution of the United States, federal law is superior to state law in all areas. So we would be subject to any change that they would subjugate to the states, no matter what it would be.
No.
Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, in order, and the federal law in the health and human services areas require that in order to receive the funding under the federal law, we would have to be in conformance with their regulations. So if we weren't, we wouldn't get the money. Right?
So, Mr. Shepherd, with the exception of federal law, we have never adopted another state's rules, with the caveat that we would continue to adopt their rules on an ongoing basis.
Mr. Chair, I am not aware of any time that that's...
Representative Tom.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in this case, in a sense, we are conforming to federal law, because federal law gives everyone in the country two choices, either California standards or federal standards. So by federal law, we couldn't have something different than California, unless it's federal, and that's... so that's essentially adopting the federal standards.
But Representative Tom, the exception is that under the other examples of federal law, if you don't get the money, and that is a big exception. This isn't exactly an apples to apples comparison here with what you have just stated. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question. Is there a possibility, I don't know the history behind this, and perhaps this is for Representative Portman or for Mr. Shepherd, the federal government currently has a law that we have two choices. We can adopt the California standards, or we can adopt the federal government standards. Is it possible that the federal government will allow states to adopt their own standards, or is that just moving in the direction of a patchwork quilt that just is not productive?
Representative Hartley, you want to speak for the federal government?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morgan, Mr. Chair, the federal debate was very clear on this point when the Clean Air Act amendments were adopted in 1975, that there is not to be a patchwork of regulations. And there can be no third car standard. There can be only the California standard or the federal standard.
Representative Morgan? Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To this point, Representative Hortman, in those discussions, it sounds like maybe you did a lot of reading on this going back in time. In those discussions, was there any concerns raised or points made about states exceeding the standard, the federal standard or the California standard?
Representative Hortman.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, a state may not exceed the standards of either California or the federal government. It has to pick one or the other.
Mr. Chair,
Olson.
And I'm going to strive to be brief, Mr. Chair, but this...
Representative Olson, I'm not striving necessarily for brevity. I'm really trying to strive here for a debate on what we're doing now, the rulemaking part of this, because that's why it's before us, and this is unique.
It
so
is
that's
unique.
Where I would like the debate, if at all possible, to stay today.
It is very unique. That's why I have a hydrogen cell here.
Representative Olson, I hope that is... a safe hydrogen cell.
Do you have a battery, Mr. Chair?
I'll show you. Olson, proceed with all caution.
Mr. Chair, it produces only about a liter of hydrogen a minute.
Representative Olson, I proceed.
What I've learned from my experience with this, Mr. Chair, to the bill, I'm very interested in this bill. The reason I asked the last question, because we can exceed these standards, and I've experienced it and witnessed it and know why we're not. And so I'm very concerned that we have a scenario where the blind is leading the blind, and now we're going to start following the blind when we could exceed the standard. I drive a 1998 Prism. My first test, I got over 50 miles per gallon. My second test, I got 46. The second successful test, I got 46 and a half. The reason I say successful test is because the automakers know that when a motor leans out, the motor burns up. So the oxygen sensor on the motor, when it senses a difference in exhaust, it automatically tells the computer on board to give the car more fuel so it doesn't burn up. That's a compensation from the fuel motor companies to prevent these standards from burning up their motors, and they become liable for it. That technology prevents this from working. So we put an onboard computer on the car, and with proper tuning,
there's people that are finding the ability to make these things work permanently. Right now, I have not yet found a mechanic that can do that, but I know some people have, and I continue working on it. So I'm very concerned that we would adopt rulemaking and go down the path where the blind have led the blind, and we could exceed these standards far beyond. I mean, I've gone out and seen these guys working on this technology and watch car motors run on 60% gas and 40% water. We are well beyond where we are today, and the bureaucracy that has been formed to support these technologies that we have today are way behind. So I'm really interested in this bill. I'd really like to work with you, Representative Portman, because I think we could do some creative things to kind of check the federal government in the direction they've gone.
Representative Hartman, you wish to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson, we could beat the standards in Minnesota. We just can't enact standards that are more stringent. And under the California standards, there is credit for alternative fuels such as hydrogen, such as E85. So under the regulatory structure that exists in California, those things are favored.
Representative Morgan.
I appreciate the concern that if California changes their standards and we pass this, we would necessarily then be changing our standards automatically to match up with California's. I respect that concern. When was California's standard that's currently in place put in place? Do we know that, Representative Hartman?
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I only know that it was before 1970.
So California's...
Representative Morgan.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So California's standard predates the Clean Air Act.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's correct.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you. Representative Hartman, if California moved to change their standard, would they be required to receive federal approval for changing that standard?
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, yes, and in fact they have changed their standard. I think it's 38 or 40 times, at least since 1970. And each time that they've changed their standard, except for the last time, the EPA has issued a waiver.
Representative Morgan.
Not right now. Thank you.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you. Representative Portman, this bill scares me to death. And it's not just because of the author. No, I take that back. I'm kidding. No, I don't know that it is. Could you tell me, I'm looking at a release that you put out back on February 11th, and in your closing statement on page 4, you indicate, and Mr. Chair, I know we're talking about the rules, and I'm going to get there. I suspect we will debate the veracity of the threat from global warming pollutants to the arcane, and I'm quoting, the arcane legal details and how they work. Well, we're here this morning. We're talking about adopting somebody else's law, and I understand that because we've been given this wonderful choice. Apparently, the federal government would like to abdicate their responsibility as well. And I'm wondering if you know everything that's in this is just a summary. And you have just responded to Mr. Olson, Representative Olson, that this provides credits. You know, I look in here, credits for hydrogen or alternative fuels. It doesn't give any specific instance when it comes to hydrogen. I will note that it refers to analytical gases, natural gas, liquefied petroleum gas, gasoline. But I don't see, it also says testing with oxygenated fuels, but I don't see what you're talking about specifically. I'm just wondering, do you know what's in this line and verse all the way through?
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I know that the standards for carbon dioxide emissions and the equivalent type emissions from the tailpipe gradually decrease over time, and we can go through those precise numbers if you'd like. The reason why hydrogen cell vehicles and E85 vehicles do so well under the California standard is because of the carbon dioxide measurement from the tailpipe. The standard is a fleet-wide average of carbon dioxide micrograms emitted per mile. And so the focus is really on the carbon dioxide coming out of the tailpipe and the leakage of the air conditioning refrigerants. And that's measurable, and they measure it on each car, and then you take the fleet that's sold. Say there's 10 Priuses and 10, you know, Camrys in the car division. You average those out and see, did you meet the fleet average? In the truck division, the standard is easier to meet. Trucks are generally more polluting, SUVs, minivans, so there's a different and lower standard for them. They can pollute more and still meet the standards.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman, I have no doubt, since I've come to know you, about the well-intentioned approach that you take to your job, and that in this case, clearly have the right mind when it comes to reducing certain emissions. That wasn't my question, and I think you've just given a very elementary description of what we would do to determine certain gases that are being released into the air and whether they're good or bad. I'm talking about what you are doing to industry and economy. And I'm talking about, have you even bothered to figure out, I'll ask you this question. I'm looking at Section 1065, and I'm not sure, this is subpart J, and it refers to field testing and portable emission measurement systems. Could you tell the committee exactly what this is, a portable emission measurement system? Are we going to have to buy all new equipment to travel around the state of Minnesota? Are we going to have to hire new people to actually do these tests? Are they going to be spot checks at truck stops? This is the thing that we need to be thinking about around here, not just the press release about how we're going to do good and we're going to protect our air. We got to think about what this is going to do to the quality of life in Minnesota on the front end. We all want the same goal, and your goal is laudable and it's appropriate. But getting there and who you're going to destroy along the way is the question I have. Could you answer that question about portable emission measurement systems? Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I'd like to first address the larger question of who I'm going to destroy along the way. All of the technological and safe, now I won't say all, much of the technological and safety innovation in the automotive industry has been driven by federal and state law. With regard to safety, when we first heard about seatbelts, the auto industry let us know that we would not be able to afford to buy cars if they had seatbelts in them. Same thing on airbags. In 1970, when Lee Iacocca testified in Congress, he said by 1975 there would be no auto industry if we adopted the Clean Air Act. When, in fact, today the healthiest car companies are the ones that are producing the most fuel-efficient cars. So, Representative Emmer, I don't intend to destroy anybody along the way to saving fuel for consumers and doing what we can to address the issue of global warming. In fact, I think the opposite would occur. I think if we were to adopt this standard, it drives technological innovation in this country that we can then export to other countries. So I think it's a job-preserving, industry-preserving type of move for us to take. With regard to the question you have about 1065J, I'd just ask for a copy, whatever it is you're looking at.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, we could beat this thing to death all day long, but I think you have just, in fact, emphasized the statement in your letter of February 11th that you have no interest in the arcane legal details. You apparently would rather go based on sophistry and things like what Lee Iacocca said in the 1970s. Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if I don't know what the status of ethanol production is in California. I have an idea that it's a little higher here in the Midwest. I probably should know more about it. But I'm wondering if Representative Hortman can tell us how this specific act And by the way, subpart J, I assume you have it already in your office, because that's all I'm doing is going based on a summary of all the different things that are in here. I'm wondering if you could tell me how the California law addresses E85 in those vehicles and where I can find that in here.
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I passed out one of my handouts is from the California Attorney General's Office. It's dated November 9th, 2007, and it explains exactly how E85 works under the California standards. I think I highlighted in yellow the portion that is relevant to the E85 issue. Under the California standards, E85 vehicles not only have lower micrograms of carbon dioxide per mile, but they get extra credit to reflect the lower carbon emissions in the production of corn-based ethanol. And the memo also states from the Attorney General's office is if we do see cellulosic or other forms of ethanol that are even less carbon intensive, that they'll receive a higher credit.
Mr. Chair, I thank you very much, Representative Hortman. Unfortunately, when this was handed out, you put it under this very neutral organization called the Star and Tribune when it comes to global warming, so I didn't dig underneath it because I've seen what they have to write on the topic. Thank you. I look forward to the arcane debate if this moves forward. Mr. Chair, before we do leave today, because I don't want to miss the opportunity, at the appropriate time, I would like to make a motion to table this wonderful piece of legislation.
Representative Emmer has moved to table House File 863. Now, did you make that motion?
I did.
You made that motion. The motion is non-debatable, but you want to at the appropriate time. You're not making the motion.
Other people have
right.
different feelings.
At the appropriate time, Representative Emmer, I'll recognize you for
Thank
the
Thank you.
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, I just did want to point out the two cases that Mark Shepard did cite in the memo on page 3, where we do make reference to the changing federal regulations under small businesses that could apply for state loans, and also the one regarding AFDC benefits. So there are cases in the past where we have made reference to regulations that would change in the future.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get my hands around the rule part of this, as you've indicated we should try to stay focused on. Again, understanding the concern about tying ourselves to a rule in another state that may change in the future, that has changed in the past. Representative Hortman, has the federal government's standards under the Clean Air Act, have they changed since initial implementation in 1970?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, they have not gone into the field of regulating greenhouse gas emissions. Last year, the United States Supreme Court decided a case, Massachusetts versus EPA. The Supreme Court directed the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases coming from motor vehicles. The EPA has not yet issued any regulations, so they're not in this field of the motor vehicle emissions world at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Hortman, let me make sure I'm understanding this correctly. We have two choices as far as adopting rules related to clean air standards with cars. We have a choice to adopt the federal standard enacted in 1970, which the federal government could choose to change at any time and has in the past, even though it hasn't addressed this area. Or we could adopt the California standard, which was adopted pre-1970, which has changed in the past, and they could choose to change again. But either way, we would be subjugating ourselves to another rulemaking body, whether it's the federal government or California, because we just don't have the option under federal law to make our own rules. Is that a correct summary? Have I gotten there?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's exactly the case.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Emmer brings up a very fair point that we should always be thinking about whenever we're talking about regulation of any kind, which is how is this going to impact the people who have to enforce it, whether it's businesses or other industries, particularly industries that are very important. So I think he's correct that we should always be asking not only who we're going to destroy, but even who we're just going to impact. I think that's true. But although I don't serve on any of the environment committees. I have been a news watcher for some time, and it seems to me that what you said is true. Although we should always be asking those questions, constantly be asking and re-asking those questions, it seems to me that the auto industry in particular has had a dismal track record, because every time, it seems, or virtually every time, there's been a regulation, there's always a prediction that it's the death knell for the auto industry, whether it was the 1970 Clean Air Act. I still remember the 1989 reenactment, I think it's called, of the Clean Air Act. Then President Bush Sr. and the auto industry said that would be the death knell of the auto industry, or it was during the Bush administration. Actually, I think that President Bush supported the reenactment of the Clean Air Act, but others said that was going to be the death knell of the auto industry. So while I think we should always ask those questions, Representative Emmer is absolutely correct. That's the fair thing to do. We don't want, just based on some fad or fashion, to eliminate thousands and thousands of jobs. But I have personally a quite low level of faith in the auto industry to talk about what will be its death knell, since it's been wrong virtually every single time.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, on page 2 of your memo, the latter part of the third paragraph, if I understood correctly, sorry, your letter, you reference that the federal government has no greenhouse gas emission standards in the environment. In order to establish those standards in the state, we have to adopt the California standard. Am I understanding that to be the real essence for this bill, why you're moving forward with this bill?
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, that's correct. Last year, we adopted the Next Generation Energy Act. We committed ourselves together as a legislature and the governor to reducing greenhouse gas emissions 15% by 2015, 30% by 2025, and 80% by 2050. This standard, should we adopt it, reduces 13.1 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent pollution by 2025. Representing, I believe, about a third or more of the total emissions from this sector in 2025. It's a huge reduction. If we were at all serious about those goals when we adopted them, we have to start taking steps. And the sooner we take steps, the easier it will be to accomplish our goals.
Representative
Mr. Chair and Representative Hortman, you also noted in your comments that these standards drive innovation. And I have just highlighted how my experience with this innovation has been inhibited and greatly damaged. This system, called an HAFC, hydrogen assist fuel cell, is currently being tested by CARBS in California. You're familiar with that. You probably know the acronym better than I. But it's the only testing entity in the country for this purpose, as I understand it. Well, they're testing this to confirm its effectiveness for addressing CO2 emissions. These standards that have been in place, whether it be California or the national standards, have greatly hindered these technologies. In fact, they, as I noted, they've caused the car companies, for protection of liability on burned-up motors, protections against burned-up motors, has actually caused a reduction in efficiency and more emissions, arguably, because whenever there's a leanness to the motor that comes from the pollution control system, the oxygen sensor overrides it and puts in more fuel. My first test, 100-mile test, 50 miles per gallon on a normally 33-mile-per-gallon car. Second test starts to go down. Third test starts to go down. It gets right back to 33 miles per gallon, because the oxygen sensor by that time has completely overridden the system that I've installed, and then we put on a new computer override that, with the computer geeks, it used to be known as mechanics, certain computer geeks know how to override the onboard computers. But we can't get them approved. They're not able to get them approved. Next week, they're releasing at the conference in Washington and a full-size SUV that gets 100 miles per gallon. I'm submitting to you, we should be on the page not just for CO2, though I'm really not on that page that strongly. As you know, I'm submitting to you, we should also be looking at emissions entirely and looking at efficiency, because that would mitigate the issue of foreign oil.
All right, members, I would hope, again, we would focus our discussion on the unique rulemaking characteristics. Should this bill proceed, there are other committees that will go into detail on the environmental impact. I have four individuals who wish to testify. I want to emphasize to those individuals the rulemaking part of this bill and not a summary of any other part of the bill. So with that, the first individual I have, Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, since I'm going to have to need it for another vote, I'd like to call the question or ask you if we could bring up my motion to table before this testimony.
Representative, you are making a motion now to table the bill.
I am, and I'd ask...
Representative Emmer moves to table the bill. That is not a debatable motion.
And I'd ask for a roll call.
Representative Emmer then asks for a roll call.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Broad? Representative Emmer?
Yes.
Representative Hilke?
No.
Representative Powell?
Aye.
Representative Hahn?
No.
Representative Thielen?
Negative.
Representative Morgan?
No.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Poppy?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Winkler?
No.
Representative Wolfsbacher?
Yes.
Chair votes no. There being 5 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. Then we have 4 individuals. Mr. Is it Urkel is first?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Urkel. I'm with the Development Center for Environmental Advocacy. To your point about the rulemaking aspect of this, I won't spend very much time because I know you want to focus on that. All I was going to point out is that under Section 177 of the Clean Air Act, states have only 2 choices. One is the default of the EPA's mobile source emission standards, or they can opt for the California standards. I have a handout that is coded red and blue, and it shows the states that have either adopted California standards or are considering adopting them. And you can, I've added some, I can find my copy. You can see how they've adopted them, either by statute or by executive order. It usually requires regulations be adopted that adopt the California standards. For the most part, these are the California Low Emission Vehicle 2 standards that we would be adopting. They're about 120 pages long. For the most part, because of the preemption effect of the Clean Air Act, you can only, whatever it is that you're going to adopt out of them, you have to adopt the whole thing or that part of it. So for rulemaking purposes, you either take the California language or you don't. And so the states that have adopted the California standards have done it in rulemakings that end up being like 7 or 8 pages long because they're just simply incorporating by reference the California standards that they want to adopt. Now they have to adopt, they don't have to adopt all of the California standards. They can adopt those that are considered severable, and there are a number of sections that are considered severable in that way, and one of them is the zero emission vehicle standards. A number of states have done that, others have not. We have removed that from the adoption that we're talking about. You can also do it by the type of vehicle, and you don't have to adopt the California reformulated gasoline standards. So basically, you just are making a number of policy decisions about what portions of the LEV II standards you want to use, and then for the most part, simply incorporate them. And for that reason, we believe that the good that the exemption under Minnesota's APA is warranted in this case.
Any questions? Thank you. The next person I have is Alyssa Shalander. Is she here? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Alyssa Shalander. I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Mr. Chair, we are here to oppose Representative Portman's bill today because of the unnecessary damage that it will have on our industry. To be clear, we represent the retailers. We don't make the cars. We just sell them. Our members are the Minnesota businesses that are caught in the middle of this debate between the automakers and the environmentalists that want you to force the automakers to make a different product. We're in a pretty unique situation here because we are, first of all, so rarely on the same side as the automakers, but secondly, because we are franchisees, this comes down to a matter of inventory for us. The automakers are telling us that the only way they can meet California standards is to restrict our supply of trucks, SUVs, and minivans on showroom floors. So that means if you are a Ford dealer and Ford Motor Company is telling you that the only way they can meet these standards is to restrict Ford F-150s from our inventories, as a Ford dealer, you can't go get a Ford F-150 from some other manufacturer. That's it. That's all you have. NAD agrees with Representative Portman that customers want more efficient vehicles. That's very true. Everyone wants to buy less gas. Everyone wants a cleaner car. But we disagree that going about achieving that goal through California's regulations is the right way to go. The federal government just passed a very aggressive energy bill just three months ago, in December of 2007. The new law that the federal government just passed will require automakers to meet to improve vehicle efficiency by 40% by the year 2020. These are the most aggressive standards that the federal government has ever required of automakers. So the federal government has already set strict but achievable goals for the industry. The California standards, by contrast, push the industry to achieve goals that the only way they can do that is to restrict supply, as I was just saying. If they're restricting supply of trucks, SUVs, and minivans to Minnesota dealers, those vehicles make up more than 55% of our market. And at a time when our industry, Minnesota dealers, are in decline. We've closed 60 dealerships in Minnesota in the last 5 years. Sales are down dramatically. So at a time when our industry is in decline and we are also now being faced with the prospect of having our supply of the most in-demand popular vehicles restricted, it's very threatening to the 20,000 employees that we have in the Minnesota retail auto industry. So we know that customers want more efficiency, and we also know that Minnesotans are demanding the utility that they can only get from trucks, SUVs, and minivans. The federal government standards allow us to have both. We can get more efficiency while still driving the vehicles that many people need here in the state. California's rules, by contrast, will restrict those options. So as explained by Representative Portman and others, if Minnesota feels still that the federal law does not isn't strict enough about restricting vehicles, then our only option, of course, is to adopt identical language to what the California Air Resources Board has done under California's Code of Regulations Title 13. Members, it is hard to know what we are adopting with this bill. California's Code of Regulations, Title 13, as referenced in the bill, is thousands of pages. It is at least 1,800 documents that incorporate a lot of things. Representative Portman, I know, I've heard her say this several times, only intends for the PCA to take out the sections of Title 13 that deal with motor vehicle emissions, But those sections of Title 13 are not referenced in her bill, and I don't know what they are. I do know that Title 13, which is the only thing that the bill does reference, regulates a whole lot more than just motor vehicle tailpipe pollutants. It regulates off-road vehicles, farm equipment, leaf blowers, you name it. Title 13 is volumes and volumes long. And I think it's a vague reference that's difficult at best to figure out. I don't know how far we will follow California's regulators in following their future changes that they will have to adopt, because they frequently change their rules in California. But I do know that that California will impose a lot of cost and on Minnesotans for not a lot of benefits. I'll just remind you that the California Air Resources Board makes rules for, in the past they have, and in the future they will, they're making rules for Californians. They are not accountable to Minnesota or Minnesota residents or Minnesota conditions. The proponents of this bill have said that in the event that California adopts a future rule change that we don't feel is right for Minnesota, all we have to do is simply opt out. Opting out would really just mean to repeal the very bill that you are considering here today. And I would respectfully suggest that the proponents of this bill will make sure that there is nothing simple about opting out of this bill in the future should Minnesota legislators choose to adopt it. So in closing, legislators, I would just like to say that this bill will mean real costs and real consequences for Minnesota in exchange for very little benefit. I encourage you to reject this bill and allow automakers to proceed in trying to meet the goals that were just recently passed by the federal government, which will also be of benefit to the whole country.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schwander, I understood Representative Portman to testify that the rules we'll be adopting will set a standard for cars and a different lower standard or lighter standard or easier standard. I'm not sure how she described it, but a different standard for light trucks and SUVs. Do you understand that to be correct, or are you understanding it differently?
Ms. Schlander.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I don't know whether that's correct or not. I do know that the automakers are saying that adopting California's regulations will mean restricted sales of trucks, SUVs, and minivans. And I'll just remind you that California's regulations that we're considering are currently not in effect anywhere. So we don't really have the luxury of looking at another state that is currently operating under California's rules, because they do not have a federal waiver right now. So it's very speculative as to what this will mean for supplies of trucks, SUVs, and minivans.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Chair, could I ask the author of the bill to step back up to the stand to clarify for me my question? Representative Portman, thank you for coming back. Is it true that the standard for cars will be different than the standard for light trucks and SUVs? In other words, there will be a lower standard or an easier standard to meet for light trucks and SUVs.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the California Attorney General document that I passed out, dated November 9, 2007, it actually has it side-by-side, the micrograms per mile, and shows you the passenger car standard and the truck standard.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Schlander, back to your comments. If cars are forced to meet a standard, and light trucks and SUVs are going to meet a different standard, you know, in the real world, I teach physics, so I do a lot of math. I don't see any way you can work out the averages that when they have to meet a different standard, that there could be any effect on the supply of cars or light trucks and SUVs in order to meet a standard that is separate for the two of them. I guess I would appreciate you enlightening me as to how a different standard for each of those two classes of vehicles would require anybody to sell fewer of either one to meet a different standard. I guess I'm interested.
Michelin.
For your explanation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, as I understand the requirements of the California law, and maybe I understand something different than Representative Portman, is that it is a combined fleet average that we're trying to achieve here. So cars and trucks, SUVs, and minivans are would have to meet a combined fleet average, and there is lengthy explanations about how they arrive at those averages. When I tried to Google it to further understand it, I'm sure Representative Morgan, with a physics background, you would be much more able to understand how they arrive at those calculations than I am.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at this sheet passed out by Mr. Urkel to all of us, and I see that New Mexico has adopted the California standard, and they have a much larger mix of trucks in the fleet in New Mexico. I see that Oregon has a much larger mix of trucks in their fleet. I see that Vermont has a slightly larger mix of trucks in their fleet, at least according to this data here. All of these states didn't seem to see a problem. Have we seen an issue in those states of sales issues, of reductions in fleet of SUVs and light trucks to those states who have even greater numbers of those trucks on their roads than we do here in Minnesota?
Ms. Landis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the part of the problem with us being able to point to these consequences is that those states are not currently under the California regulations because California does not currently have a waiver to impose them, which means any other state that has adopted California's regulations does not have a waiver to impose them.
One final question, Mr. Chair, and I guess I'd like to ask the author of the bill to come back up again so I can just be absolutely clear as we're moving forward here. Representative Portman, what you're saying is that because there are two different standards for cars, one standard for cars and one for light trucks and SUVs, that there is absolutely no reason for any reductions in the automakers supplying to the retailers of any one particular class. So that would in no way help to meet the standard of either of those classes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, they are two separate standards. There's a car standard, and it's a fleet-wide average among cars, and then there's a truck standard, and it's a fleet-wide average among the trucks that are sold. So, and the truck standard is, in 2016, at least 50% more polluting. So what will probably happen is that the price of diesel vehicles and the price of E85 vehicles would fall, and their availability would increase because those vehicles meet the standards better.
All right. I have two more individuals that wish to testify, Molly Schultz and Eric Hyland. If they would come up and briefly address the issue, if they want to, on rulemaking, and then we're going to move in. If you would stay, Representative Hartman, where you are, just in case there's a question.
Mr. Chair, Molly Schultz is ill, and she won't be here today.
Mr. Howell, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Eric Hyland. I'm with Meserly and Kramer, and I'm representing the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers today. The Alliance is a trade association of 10 car and light truck manufacturers, including BMW, Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, Mazda, Mercedes-Benz, Mitsubishi Motors, Porsche, Toyota, and Volkswagen. And I think what I'd like to do right now is kind of offer a little bit of clarification on some of the conversations that have taken place. To Representative Morgan's point and to Representative Hortman, there are two different standards for passenger vehicles and light trucks. That is true. However, the California regulations require a fleet-wide average MPG/CO2 emissions. And so And the manufacturers have testified in federal court that the only way they can meet the California standards, particularly in the early years, is because they would have to sell a lot more of the Priuses, and their sales would have to be restricted to larger vehicles because they have to be a fleet-wide average, combining both the both passenger and trucks. And so that is the very important point here, is that the only way the manufacturers can meet those standards in California, again, if they were ever to be implemented, because I think it's really important for members to understand that even of the 12 states that have passed California standards, all of which passed those standards before the federal government passed a very aggressive new energy bill that, as Ms. Philander pointed out, requires the manufacturers to increase miles per gallon by 2020 by 40%, which equates to a 30% reduction in CO2. There hasn't been a state that has passed California, to my knowledge, since those regulations. And regarding the previous testimony regarding the interplay of E85, and I want to point out, I think I distributed, the committee has a copy of this document. On the back side, it tries to uncomplicate what obviously, members, is a very complicated regulatory scheme in California. But as you can see, there are three essential elements to the California regulation. One deals with traditional emissions, NOx and VOx, what we all think of as smog-producing pollutants. The middle box is the ZEV mandate. I would point out that Representative Hortman's bill now does not adopt the ZEV mandate. That is the only severable part of the California standards that states can opt out of. I would argue that that was done primarily because there are some real concerns in the interplay between the use of flex fuel vehicles and alternative fuels. Not a single flex fuel vehicle was able to meet that ZEV mandate in California, so I believe that was the motivation for taking that out of the bill. And then there's the CO2 regulations, which everybody is talking about. Another important distinction, while California's regulations were passed, I believe, in the late 60s, when states started adopting California was essentially after 2004, when California passed their first regulation on CO2. And that's when the states started adopting California. But again, there's not a single state in the country that has been allowed to implement the CO2 regulations, because, as Ms. Schillander said, the federal government, the EPA, has not granted California the waiver to implement their standards. I would also point out to the members that while the proponents of this make the argument that there are tremendous incentives based on the California system, I will tell you from the manufacturer's perspective, it's almost impossible to take advantage of those incentives, and I'll tell you why. There are credits for selling flex fuel vehicles in California. However, the CARB board is not going to grant that credit to any manufacturer unless the manufacturer can prove that the customer who purchased that vehicle is burning only E85 fuel. Now, I don't know, well, I can say that California hasn't quite figured out how they're going to make the manufacturer provide that information, and I quite frankly don't know that Minnesota is in the position of trying to track consumers what sorts of fuel folks are using in their vehicle. But I would say that as a result of that, that manufacturers are going to be in no position to guarantee that the customers driving our vehicles are only burning E85 fuel, and therefore we're not going to be able to take advantage of those credits.
All right. Are there any questions? And let's be brief, because we're now running overtime. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions for Mr. Hyland. Has there been an increase in auto sales in the states neighboring California since they've implemented all these different standards?
Mr. Hyland.
Is that a statistic you have on hand?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I don't know. Again, because the standards haven't been implemented, there isn't any market forces at work currently, because California has not been allowed to implement those standards. So in a way, I'm kind of disappointed that we don't have some empirical evidence to say this is what happens in states that adopt California, because the reality is nobody's been able to do it so far.
Mm-hmm.
And so my association you know, strongly supported the passage of the H.R. 6, the new energy bill. We worked with the national auto dealers. We worked with the UAW. We believe that the federal standards are very, very aggressive. I will tell you that in Europe, for example, the average miles per gallon increase on a year-to-year basis is about 2%. With the new federal law, it's going to require manufacturers to need about a 4% increase every year. Contrast that with the early years of California, we're talking double-digit increases year after year. And that's why manufacturers simply, the only way they're going to be able to make that meet that standard is to sell a lot of four-cylinder vehicles, and we're going to have to restrict our sales of a lot of eight-cylinder vehicles.
Representative Kalin, you're on my list to the rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll come back.
Representative Hortman, we just heard that no state since the passage of the Federal Energy Act, the 2007 bill, has tried to adopt stronger standards. I understand that there are a number of states that have filed suit, joined together to file suit to be able to push the EPA to grant waivers. Has the number of states diminished since the 2007 Energy Act that have joined that suit, or can you comment on some of the frustrations maybe related to this rule?
Representative Hart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, the number hasn't reduced of states that are in the lawsuit. It's increased since then. Minnesota is in the lawsuit. We're in an odd situation that since the Federal Energy Act was passed in December and the waiver was denied in December, that Arnold Schwarzenegger is writing my talking points on this bill. Because basically he's made the point that this is pretty atypical conduct, is not supported by fact or by law, and the agency's own staff acknowledged that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last question. Is there currently a conversion van that is being manufactured that would meet these goals set forth in the emission standards?
That's Mr. Hyland?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, there are all sorts of vehicles that on an individual basis can meet the standards. Again, the problem for the manufacturers is the standard is based on their entire fleet-wide sales. And so while there are Tahoes that would currently meet the standards by 2016, and Mr. Urkel usually has a little picture of a Chevy Tahoe that meets that standard, the problem is we're not going to be able to sell, potentially offer for market, all the vehicles that the consumers might demand. Because, again, in order for us to meet the standard, we have to make sure that we're probably, and I don't want to say that this is the correct ratio, but to kind of illustrate kind of the market dynamic, for every one big Tahoe that we'd sell, we might have to sell two Priuses. And so that's the kind of calculation that as manufacturers we're going to have to make. And again, the manufacturers have testified in federal court that that's the only way they can meet that standard.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson, quickly, please.
So this means, like, if my brother-in-law wanted to go in and purchase a conversion van because that's the only vehicle he can actually drive, he might be limited on his consumer choice or not even have an option at his traditional dealership. Is that correct?
That is correct. Mr. Hyland.
Thanks.
All right, Representative Lawrence, one brief statement, and then we're going to vote.
Mr. Chair, I think that rebutting the statements that have just been made is something that are left for the Commerce Committee.
And that will be my motion, members. I will renew it that House File 863 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Goes on its way. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the minutes from Tuesday, February 26th.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. That motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.